does the Park Service have the right on Alaska's waters to enforce Park Service regulations and laws?
The bigger question that's unresolved in the Yukon Charlie court case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the effort to determine why two killer whales died on the Nooshigak River.
We went down the Nooshigak. It was roughly 5.5 hours to bring the killer whale down.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine.
A federal magistrate in Fairbanks issued his long-awaited decision Tuesday on the case of Jim Wild, the central man arrested by National Park Service rangers on the Yukon River last fall. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Judge Scott Orovec found Wild guilty of the three charges that were contested during the trial that began 6 months ago. They are interfering with the Park Service, violating a lawful federal order, and operating an unregistered boat. But in a 31-page ruling issued Tuesday afternoon, Orovec concluded that Wild was not guilty of the most serious charge, disorderly conduct. Wild didn't seem very interested in talking about the case when contacted at his home in Central Tuesday evening, except to say that he was surprised. Despite his reputation as something of a firebrand, Wild seemed subdued because he'd been advised by his attorney to not say much, especially about appealing the conviction, until after he's sentenced on October 28th.
As he could still change his mind again. Quite disappointed, you can say that. Over 6 months' time, I expected him quite a bit different.
The case stems from Wild's refusal on September 16, 2010, to comply with park rangers' orders to shut down his boat motor in the middle of the Yukon as he was making his way upriver on a stretch that runs through the Yukon Charlie National Preserve. That was followed by a brief chase with the rangers in pursuit, during which time the rangers pointed a pistol and shotgun at the 71-year-old Wild and his elderly wife and friend, who also were in the boat. The rangers testified that they felt threatened when Wild yelled profanities at them, then gunned his throttle and swerved his boat during the pursuit. They said that force was necessary to subdue the unruly arrestee after the boats were ashore. The controversial case and trial has stirred up deep-seated anti-federal sentiment among many here in the interior. Congressman Don Young joined the outcry, declaring the case another example of the Fed's heavy-handed presence. Wild says he appreciates all that solidarity.
Well, I thank all the supporters, and that's about the limit I can do right now.
Some have suggested that Wild's arrest could serve as a test case on the long-standing legal question of whether the feds have jurisdiction over the Yukon and other waterways that Alaska officials contend are state-owned navigable waters. Wild's attorney, Bill Satterberg, tried to argue that point at trial, but Orovec dismissed the argument and declared that the preserve has the authority to patrol the river. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The ruling in the Jim Wild case likely will not be the end of a dispute over regulation of state-owned waters inside Alaska National Parks. Wild's attorney, Bill Satterberg, will not comment on the specifics of the case or a possible appeal until after Wild's October 28th sentencing. Satterberg unsuccessfully tried to get the charges thrown out early on by challenging Park Service jurisdiction over state waters, a legal battle he says isn't over.
And that's the issue which is at the crux of this entire dispute, which is, does the Park Service have the right on Alaska's waters to enforce Park Service regulations and laws? And the state of Alaska in its briefing, as well as Jim Wild in his briefing, as well as John Sturgeon in his complaint, maintain that that authority does not exist.
Meanwhile, the National Park Service welcomes this week's guilty ruling in the Wild criminal case, which generated ill will among some interior residents during the last year, especially in the Yukon-Charlie area community of Eagle. Park Service spokeswoman Morgan Worthen says the Park Service does not see the ruling as a vindication of law enforcement some locals have called heavy-handed.
The bottom line is the National Park Service, we continue to look forward to rebuilding, maintaining, and really growing community relations, especially with Eagle residents and other towns.
Worthen says a procedural change announced this spring, refocusing Yukon-Charlie law enforcement on shore, will remain. She says the move reflects safety concerns, not a lack of authority. One of the killer whales found dead on the Nooshogak River was pregnant. A necropsy performed at the beach in Dillingham yesterday found the whale was carrying a late-term fetus. The team from NOAA performing the necropsy says that may indicate pregnancy complications contributed to her death. There was no sign the whale was harmed by humans, but the full results of the necropsy won't be available for several weeks. KDLG's Daisha Eaton was at the beach during the necropsy and has the story.
The sight of a dead killer whale drew a crowd of dozens to the beach just below the city dock in Dillingham Tuesday. Students snapped photos of the orca with their cell phones while Robert Walton with the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward did crowd control.
We're on the ground. We're going to be here as soon as possible.
Teachers from Dillingham High School brought their classes down to get a look at the whale, which was towed to the dock Monday night by a group of citizens. Gary Klein was one of them. Klein, who is a protection coordinator with Nunumta Alukastai, an Alaska Native Conservation Group based in Dillingham, helped coordinate the trip. He says they found the orca about 18 miles upriver.
It was stuck between a log and the bank. We successfully pulled it out. We basically lassoed the tail and pulled it tight and began our slow journey back home, towing the whale. We went down the Nooshogak. It was roughly 5.5 hours to bring the killer whale down.
The whale sat overnight. Tuesday afternoon, a NOAA team of 4 veterinarians and 2 assistant vets arrived in Dillingham to try to find out what killed the whale. The 3 killer whales were first spotted swimming far up the Nooshogak River back in September. NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service caught wind of the situation in early October. Photos revealed the orcas were likely suffering from freshwater stress. NOAA began coordinating aerial surveys to pinpoint the whale's exact location, with the intention of putting together a possible intervention. Saturday, 2 of the 3 whales turned up dead. The 3rd whale, a juvenile, was last seen swimming down the Nooshogak River toward Bristol Bay on Saturday. Dr. Judy St. Ledger is leading the NOAA team of investigators, which will perform a necropsy on the whale that was towed to Dillingham. St. Ledger is the director of veterinary pathology for SeaWorld in San Diego. With the tide coming up, St. Ledger began coordinating logistics.
We're organizing with the local folks here at the dock to see if we can arrange to move the whale in an area where we can safely work on her away from the water coming in. We'd like to start work as soon as we can. So if we can get her out of the water, basically we'll work until either we're done or it's too dark to work.
St. Ledger says once the first necropsy is done, she and her team plan to head up the Nooshogak River to perform another necropsy on the 2nd dead whale.
We haven't finished the logistics of how to get to the 2nd whale, but the game plan is to do a necropsy exam on this animal and then to do the necropsy on the 2nd animal, because we'd like to learn as much as we can. And the sooner we can get the work done, the better samples we'll get to see what's going on.
St. Ledger said she'd like to get a look at the 3rd whale, the juvenile orca that was last seen alive near Bristol Bay.
Right now, there are folks who've been looking for that animal. To this point, I haven't had reports that the animal's been seen.
St. Ledger says it will likely be weeks or even months before her team can pinpoint exactly what killed the orcas. Meantime, Alan Miller, a ranger with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Dillingham, says he wants to make sure people know it's not okay to take any parts of the whales.
They are looking at what caused the death, and they don't want people messing with the carcass and interfering with their results and the work they're doing.
The community is coordinating with NOAA to preserve the skeleton of the killer whale for educational purposes, but that'll have to wait until after the NOAA team has completed their investigation. St. Ledger says she's hoping to finish up by the end of the week. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
North Slope communities are having some success with fall whaling. Johnny Aiken is the executive director of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission in Barrow. Aiken says Barrow crews have landed 2 whales so far this fall.
The crews out that are out boating have not been seeing as many whales as they used to this time of the year. What we heard was that the whales are still hanging around the Prudhoe Bay area off Milne Point.
But the villages of Coktovik and Nuiqsut are having better luck.
Coktovik landed all their whales, all 3 of them, and also Nuiqsut also landed 3 whales. So those 2 villages have been very successful.
AEWC has 11 member villages that share 72 to 75 strikes each year between spring and fall whaling season. Nuiqsut can take up to 4 whales, but Aiken says the 3 they landed this year were large. All 3 averaged 50 feet, which translates into around 50 tons per whale. Nuiqsut gave their 4th strike back to AEWC for another village to use. Aiken says the weather has been rough, making it difficult for Barrow crews to get out. He says the lack of fall ice makes it more dangerous.
We have not seen any ice in the fall for, 10 years. In the past, we used to have ice, and it was good to have ice because it kept the seas calm. Now that we don't have ice, it's been pretty rough out there.
Aiken says Wainwright and Point Lay whalers have been out, but have not had success so far this fall. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new carrier will start flights to Dutch Harbor.
There is obviously a fairly big void. When was the last time you tried to get a flight out of Dutch Harbor?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust is looking to swap thousands of acres of land with the U.S. Forest Service, and it's hoping to do so with the blessing of a regional group of Tongass National Forest stakeholders. The trust presented its plan to the Tongass Futures Roundtable, a group of stakeholders representing communities, organizations, and tribal governments throughout Southeast Alaska. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust owns more than 60,000 acres of land in Southeast, not counting a massive tract on Icy Cape. It's required by law to get the most value it can out of those lands and then use that money to support Alaskans with mental illnesses. Oftentimes, getting value out of the lands involves logging. But much of the land it owns is situated near populated areas in Southeast Alaska, which makes it unsuitable for logging because it would disrupt view sheds or even pose safety risks. For example, residents in Petersburg's Mitkoff Highway Homeowners Association are worried that logging of Mental Health Trust lands near the road could lead to more landslides.
We recognized the concerns that the communities in Southeast Alaska have about harvesting timber on these lands.
That's Greg Jones, executive director of the Trust Land Office, which has been around since 1994. He says since then, 1994, they've been trying to figure out how to meet their requirement to get value from the land while still respecting community uses and the land's proximity to people's backyards.
What's gelled over the last 5 years has been a proposal to trade the lands with the Forest Service for other lands that could be logged without having the impact on the major communities that are currently that are backed by those lands.
So the Mental Health Trust is offering tens of thousands of acres to the Forest Service. In Sitka, those parcels include a large tract along Catlin Bay and a piece of land near Mount Verstovia. More tracts are near Ketchikan, both north of town and on Gravina Island. The Mitkoff Highway tract near Petersburg would also be under Forest Service control, as would a narrower piece of land south of Wrangell. Other possibilities include lands near Skagway, Juneau, and Myers Chuck. The proposal met with interested caution at Tuesday's meeting of the Tongass Futures Roundtable. Some said the idea of a land swap makes perfect sense. Others said they felt the same way, but they worried about what would happen to the land the trust received. How would it be logged? Would the jobs be sustainable? Lindsay Ketchell is executive director of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council and a member of the roundtable.
I feel that the urban communities that were identified clearly have areas that don't make sense to log. So let's pull ourselves out of there. But I'm also equally concerned to figure out where will that solution set be, because most likely it'll be on Prince of Wales. And we really have to find that balance there.
Ketchell says it's important to look at the volume of logging that's already occurred on Prince of Wales Island.
Can we really create some timber opportunities there? I described value-added options versus wholesale export. Can we create some jobs? And can we spread it around where in the least ecologically, you know, challenging areas? Is there some solution space there? And I'm encouraged that we're going to be searching for that solution here.
The plan is to handle the swap at the administrative level, which is relatively faster than going through Congress. But even then, Tongass National Forest Supervisor Forrest Cole says it's a 64-step process. At the moment, there's no formal proposal, and the Forest Service hasn't come up with the lands it would be willing to exchange with the trust. In fact, Cole says the first step is simply to agree to initiate the process, to agree to take the first step. Again, Greg Jones from the Mental Health Trust.
It would be blindingly fast if it were done in 2.5 years. More likely, it'll take 3 to 5 years to get it completed.
So it probably won't happen quickly. But Jones says it will happen out in the open, and that is why he's seeking the blessing of the Tongass Futures Roundtable.
It's going to be a public process. So we're going to involve all the communities that we impact. The roundtable offers an opportunity to have a single voice representing those communities if the communities want it. Now, in addition to the roundtable, we will be talking to each of the communities individually.
Those individual meetings could be important to communities like Wrangell and Petersburg, whose leaders are among those who withdrew their membership in the roundtable earlier this year. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Greg Jones, executive director of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, is expected to speak to the Chickaloon Community Council tonight, according to Council President Frankie Barker. The Mental Health Trust has announced it is offering more than 11,000 acres for coal exploration and development near the Matanuska Valley community. The proposed lease could result in significant long-term revenue to support programs for beneficiaries of the trust, according to trust officials. The tract near Chickaloon could contain high-quality coal. A best interest decision regarding the use of the land up for coal development was finalized on October 6th. Notice of the intent to start the application for leases was released the same day. The lease offering is being managed by the Mental Health Trust Land Office, a division within the Department of Natural Resources. The public will have 30 days to make written comments regarding the lease offering. Penn Air dominates air travel in southwestern Alaska, but now a new airline is jumping into the mix, albeit on a small scale. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
Starting in December, it might be easier to get flights in and out of Unalaska. Ace Air Cargo is adding scheduled passenger flights to and from Anchorage on its Beechcraft 1900 Model C. The plane will hold up to 9 passengers each way, and they're planning on having anywhere between 1 and 4 flights a day. Sherry Pugh, who does fleet support for Fish Company of Alaska, says the extra capacity is a relief.
Every single day, all year, has been horrible. All year.
Penn Air, the only existing carrier, reduced the number of passengers per flight earlier this year to help ensure baggage delivery. The move effectively cut 21 seats a day, which Pugh says has resulted in a serious seat crunch. She was at the airport on Monday arranging a charter with Ace for 19 fishermen who had been stuck in Anchorage for several days.
It's a lower cost than keeping the boat here.
Ace Senior Director of Operations Greg Hawthorne says the scheduled flights won't be in direct competition with Penn Air.
This is not us against them, believe me, okay? This is about another company coming down there and trying to help out where there is obviously a fairly big void.
The flights will cost about the same, and people flying with Ace won't be able to earn or use their Alaska Air miles. But Hawthorne says just getting a seat is more important for most people.
When was the last time you tried to get a flight out of Dutch Harbor?
After 3 days of waiting for a flight to Anchorage, Penn Air passenger Doug Dixon was itching to leave.
I'd pay double easily. My time goes for $180 an hour. So go do the math.
For people traveling beyond Anchorage, it might be a more complicated question. FCA's Sherry Pugh says Penn Air's codeshare agreement with Alaska Airlines makes it easier to get people to the lower 48.
So it's going to be a juggling game, I think, to try and figure what the seat fare is, Dutch Harbor to Anchorage, and then find a cheaper Anchorage-Seattle flight.
ACE plans to start taking online bookings in the next few weeks. Flights are scheduled to begin in early December. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Alaska's redistricting plan has won approval from the U.S. Justice Department, an important hurdle that must be cleared before the plan can be implemented. Under federal voting rights law, the plan can't weaken the ability of the Alaska Native community to elect candidates of their choosing. The redistricting board needed at least 9 districts in which an Alaska Native or Native-backed candidate was likely to be elected to maintain the seats held by those candidates after the 2000 redistricting. The plan still faces a challenge in state court and must be upheld before it can be implemented. The state of Alaska has named Kodiak volunteer firefighter Jim Pickett as Alaska's Firefighter of the Year. Pickett worked with the state to get a grant to bring nearly 900 smoke detectors to Kodiak and then spent the summer installing them with some help from his wife, Keela, and a few firefighter buddies. Bayside Fire Chief Bob Himes.
He just took phone calls at home and signed people up, and he went out on his own time and installed them.
Pickett was honored at last week's Kodiak Island Borough Assembly meeting for not only his work installing smoke detectors, but also for educating kids about fire safety and conducting child safety seat and bike helmet inspections. He's been with the department for nearly 20 years and says he was surprised by many of the houses he visited.
It's pretty amazing that a lot of the places here in town, their smoke detectors weren't working. You know, you go into a house full of little kids in there to check their detectors. None of them were working, so it made me feel good when I left the house. They were workable smoke detectors.
Pickett says he hopes to bring more smoke detectors to Kodiak when the money becomes available. Though the program is over for now, Pickett remains committed to the goal of providing smoke detectors to anybody who needs one.
Somebody contacts me and says, hey, I need a smoke alarm. I'll get him one. I'll track one down and get it for him.
Meanwhile, he's planning to teach fire prevention to seniors and is looking for money to get the department a fire prevention trailer and a Sparky the Fire Dog costume. Hundreds of boats are docked at downtown Kodiak's St. Paul Harbor. In one of them lives a 74-year-old Japanese man who left his recycling business in Osaka to travel across the Pacific Ocean. KMXT's Jennifer Canfield visited with him.
Katsumi Murataka's friend, who had made the trip before, told him that by sailboat, going from Osaka, Japan to Dutch Harbor only took 25 days. Murataka spent 44 days at sea. With help from translator Kazu Barnes, Murataka explains that he wasn't prepared.
He thought it is a simple trip, and he heard it is a simple trip. So he didn't have enough food. He didn't have enough supplies.
So what did you do?
So 何をしましたか? 水がないし食べ物なくなって。いや、まだそこまで行かなかったらもうほとんどそこと言っとったもんね。 He had a vision. So somebody sitting beside him And because it's not enough food, not enough greens, so he has kind of a vision, somebody singing beside him.
Oh, delusion.
Uh-huh. Oh. Vision, yeah. So he was just praying, don't tell me, jump into the water.
Before Morataka arrived in Dutch Harbor, starved and delusional, his boat, the Only You, had suffered engine trouble and a torn sail. He says that though the first leg of his trip was very dangerous, it was also new and exciting.
Hard.
It was difficult.
Hard. Trouble every day.
何が大変でしたか? 何が大変?旅というよりも... 何?
旅は好きなんです。旅好きなんですよ。
He loves travel.
ジャパンではもうずっとあちこち行ったから、もうこれはもうガッツしかないと思う。
He sails. It's all Japan. So no place to go in Japan. So he's looking forward another world.
After Dutch Harbor, he came to Kodiak, where he's been for the last 2 months. The same friend that told him it took 25 days to get from Japan to Alaska told him about Kazu Barnes, the one who is translating for him. He said there's a nice lady in Kodiak who knows Japanese, and she'll be able to help you. Meanwhile, the 74-year-old is taking English as a second language classes at the college and prepping his boat for the next leg of his adventure. He's been sailing around Japan for over 35 years and had seen pretty much everything there was to see there. After Kodiak, he plans to circumnavigate the Pacific Ocean, stopping in Vancouver, San Francisco, Tahiti, Australia, Indonesia, and finally returning to Japan. He expects the entire trip will take 2.5 years. Morataka says he's happy to be wintering here.
Many wonderful people in Kodiak. And many people help him.
I'm Jennifer Canfield.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. Wet reports tonight from Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Dacia Eaton in Dillingham, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, and Jennifer Canfield in Kodiak. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The 8th Annual Bioneers in Alaska Conference, Adapting to a Changing Planet, is October 14th through the 16th at UAA. Presentations include renewable energy, urban homesteading, sustainability workshops, and keynote speaker Thomas Elpel. Storyteller Tamarack Song will speak at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on October 15th as part of the conference, but tickets are available to the public at the door. Details at bioneersinak.org. This message sponsored by Green Star.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.